Welcome, everyone, to the fifth live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. My name's Tammy Simon. I'm the founder of Sounds True, and I'll be your host for this session. In this session, Stephen Porges will be teaching on connectedness as a biological imperative, understanding the consequences of trauma, abuse, and chronic stress through the lens of the polyvagal theory. Stephen is broadcasting live from Bloomington, Indiana, while I and the Sounds True team are all here in our Boulder studio. Please note that a free recording of this session will remain accessible for 24 hours. If you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, transcripts from each session, and bonus gifts from our presenters. And now it's my joy and my honor to introduce you to Stephen Porges. Stephen Porges is a distinguished university scientist at Indiana University, where he directs the Trauma Research Center within the Kinsey Institute, as well as a professor of psychiatry at the University of North Carolina. He's a former recipient of a National Institute of Mental Health Research Scientist Development Award and has published more than 250 peer-reviewed scientific papers across several disciplines. In 1994, he proposed the polyvagal theory, a theory that links the evolution of the mammalian autonomic nervous system to social behavior and emphasizes the importance of physiological state in the expression of behavioral problems and psychiatric disorders, as well as many other implications of the polyvagal theory, which we're going to be exploring here today. Stephen, I am really overjoyed that you're able to join us here for our Neuroscience Training Summit. Welcome.
Thank you, Tammy. It's a pleasure to be on Sounds True with you. Thank you.
Thanks for making the time to engage in an educational function, if you will, as well as all of your research and writing, and to speak to the general public in this way. I really appreciate you considering that a priority in terms of your work in the world.
I think it's really one of the major responsibilities. Once you discover or learn about new things, the real responsibility is how to translate it into a language that other people can understand and use. And that's why I'm very pleased to be here with you.
All right. And translate we will. This session is called Connectedness as a Biological Imperative, and we'll be delivering this session, if you will, through a dialogue. You and I will be having a conversation, and we'll be showing connection by having a conversation as we explore the polyvagal theory. I also want to let our listeners know that you're connected too. We're connected to you, and you're connected to us. And if you have questions yourselves that you'd like to ask Stephen, you can write them in the dialogue box that's under the video player, and then hit submit, and they will find their way to me right here in the Sounds True studio. And in the final part of our session today, I'm going to bring forward as many questions as I can that are coming from the audience. Okay, Stephen, let's get started. The first place I'd like to begin is going back in your career, back to the early 1990s, and having you lay out for us how you discovered the polyvagal theory. What were you doing? Take us back in time.
Well, it's an interesting journey, but I'll take you back even earlier. I'll take you back a few decades further back. I was doing research looking initially at autonomic measures, that means measures of heart rate and physiology, as an intervening variable, meaning something between how we perceive stimuli and how we react to it. So it's somewhere between the stimulus and our reaction was our physiological state. So when we're in certain physiological states, certain events are very pleasing, and in other physiological states, they may be irritating. And so I started to develop a research program starting moving into young infants, actually newborn babies. And I was trying to develop a technology that would measure these intervening variables that would be predictive of how a newborn infant would develop. So in the sense, a measure of risk. And so I was measuring a variable that was, it was heart rate and was heart rate variability. And what I was doing, actually, I had heart rate variability has become quite a popular variable now. People do measure it, and it's the pattern of heart rate that changes on each beat. And we have a predominant respiratory rhythm. And I actually was the first scientist to quantify heart rate variability. That goes back actually to the early 1970s and the late 1960s. So now I'm already given too much away. I've been around a long, long time. So the heart rate variability measure, I was bringing it into the intensive care room and neonatal nursery, so the neonatal intensive care unit, to see if we could predict the development of babies. And I was having really a good time doing good research, and I identified that babies who were doing well had more heart rate variability, and babies who were doing poorly, like high-risk preterm babies, had less heart rate variability. And so I thought this would be a very good standard measure, and since the heart rate variability was really an indicator of how a nerve from the brain to the heart was working, it was actually a very good measure of basically your neurophysiological state, and it was coming through a major nerve called the vagus, which we'll get into later. But in the early 1990s, I had published a paper, and the paper described that heart rate variability, which I called an index of vagal tone, more vagal activity to the heart, was a protective factor. It was good for the baby. And this was published in a major journal called Pediatrics. And when the article came out, I got a letter, and the letter was from a neonatologist who said, when I was in medical school, I learned that the vagus could kill you. He says, perhaps too much of a good thing is bad. Now, this to me became what I call the vagal paradox. How could a nerve connecting the brain to the heart convey something that was very good for you, protective, and then something that was also lethal? It just didn't make any sense to me. So I took it as a challenge, and I started to work very hard to try to figure this one out. I went into the literature. I used to say I went into the bowels of the National Institutes of Health Library, because I had an appointment at the NIH at that time. And I studied comparative neuroanatomy, I studied neurophysiology, and I tried to figure this out. And it was when I got into the comparative literature, and comparative literature is when you look across species to try to make inference regarding evolutionary patterns, that the lights came on. Because what it identified was basically we had two different vagal pathways. One which could kill us, and one which could protect us. The one that could kill us, we inherited from earlier vertebrates, such as ancient extinct reptiles, who used the vagal system as a defense system. So when they were challenged, they shut down, they immobilized. So if you think of a turtle, or you think of any type of lizard, when they're being challenged, their major defense system is an immobilization defense system. But with mammals, we have a newer evolutionary newer mobilization system, which is a fight-flight system. And then we also have this newer vagal circuit, which is quite interesting because it is linked to the neuroregulation of the face and the muscles of the face and head. And I'll go into that a little later. But the point was that when I got this paradox, I started to figure it out and realized that there was an evolutionary tradition or trajectory in which we had an immobilization circuit, which was part of our autonomic nervous system. Then we had a newer fight-flight or sympathetic nervous system. And then we had a newest vagal circuit, which enabled connectedness and social behavior to enable us to feel safe with each other. So I just want to hold it there for a moment. But that evolutionary trajectory also provided a model in how the nervous system reacted to the world, because we respond with newer circuits before we respond with older. So now you start seeing how this links into adaptive behavior and stress. To deconstruct that is, first we use our head and our face and our voice, and when that doesn't help us get into safe places, we run and use our trunk and limbs, and when that doesn't work, we shut down, we immobilize. And now we move into the world of trauma, because many people who've experienced severe traumatic events have had shutdown experiences, and the psychiatric and the psychological community, and even the public community, didn't understand that defense response, because we had learned so much that defense was about fighting. It wasn't about immobilizing. So that's kind of the nutshell of the theory and where it came from.
Now, Stephen, there's a lot in what you just said, and I want to go back and unpack just a couple of things, because one of the things I learned in researching and preparing for this conversation is that a preterm baby doesn't develop this new type of evolutionary mammalian vagus circuitry. And so that was really the piece that you were struggling with.
What I often say is that the answer to the vagal paradox was in the neonatal intensive care unit, because this new, what I call new mammalian vagal circuit, really comes in during the last trimester. And with preterm babies, if they're born before 30 weeks gestational age, they don't have any access to this new mammalian vagus. So their normal defense systems are really to mobilize first and then to shut down. And what is the greatest fear of a mother of a preterm baby? And that's bradycardias and apneas. And that means heart rates going so slow that it doesn't support oxygenation of the brain. And that's what they watch in the intensive care unit. And the reason they're vulnerable is that they don't have this new myelinated vagal pathway. So you're absolutely correct. The insights came from the problem of studying the preterm, and then the insights of what the model was also came from the preterm.
Now, let's get into, for people who are unfamiliar, what exactly the vagus nerve is in terms of where it is in the body, you know, how far it goes and extends, etc.
Well, we learn things in a very, at least from archaic way. We think nerves do work. Nerves are really pathways or conduits. They have lots of fibers in it, lots of wires. The vagus starts in the brainstem and goes from the brainstem out to virtually every major organ in your body, all those visceral organs. So it does a lot of work in terms of regulating those organs. But what we forget is that the vagus not only is a motor nerve, meaning brain down to the organ, but also about 80% of the fibers are sensory. So it's a surveillance nerve. It's evaluating the status of our organs. So that's the first statement of the nerve itself. The nerve doesn't do anything. It's the fibers inside the nerve. And they go down from the brain to the organs and back from the organs to the brain. But the understanding of the polyvagal theory doesn't stop there. It says, where do those nerves in the brain come from? Where do the nerves in the vagus, where do they come from in the brain? And the motor fibers come from two different areas. And this is where it gets very, very interesting. And it may be important insight for many of the people who may be watching this interview. The fibers that come from the newer area that are the protective fibers come from an area of the brain that also regulates all the muscles, the striated muscles of our face and head. And that includes muscles that give us facial expressivity, muscles that give us vocalization, our ability to ingest through sucking and swallowing and coordinating with breathing. And there are muscles off that go into the middle ear that tense the middle ear muscles. And if they're tense, we become less sensitive to background low frequency noises. But if they're not tense, we are great at detecting predator sounds, but we have difficulty understanding human voice. It shifts what we're able to hear. So what we can now see is that new vagal circuit, when it is working to inhibit and calm us down, it creates animation in our face, animation in our voice, intonation in voice, prosody, and we are better attuned to listen to others. So what we often can see in other people and hear from their voices is whether or not they're approachable, whether or not you can get connected with them based upon the intonation of their voice and based upon the expression of their face. And what you have to understand through the evolutionary history is that for mammals to exist, they had to be connected to each other. They had to signal conspecifics. Those are their own species. And they could only do that. They had to reflect their physiological state to the conspecifics. And that's what vocalization started. That was the origin of vocalizations. Vocalizations were projecting the individual physiological state in an acoustic range. And we still do that today, but we don't respect it as much. So intonation of voice is critical. Our bodies respond to it. So if you have a puppy or a dog, how do you talk to the dog? You use an intonation of voice that triggers or gives sounds of safety, cues of safety. If you have a baby, how do you talk to the baby? You use a lot of intonation and voice. So this is wired into us, and that's to get this facial neural network that is linked to the neural regulation of the heart. And it goes in both directions. When you are scared or mobilized, what happens to your voice? What does your face look like? What sounds are you hearing?
So conspecifics means other members of my species. So I have to say, as a fellow conspecific,
yes,
Stephen, I find your voice very beautiful and welcoming and heartful, and we're having a positive connection here with our voices and with the audience, and that's keeping us all calm as we go into this topic. Yes, we're having a good conspecific connection.
Exactly, because if we didn't, the material, you'd lose the material. So listen, there's a method behind the madness here. So in a sense, the talk is the theory, and that's what you'll leave. The interview is the theory. Our connectedness is a manifestation of the theory. And when you hear a person speak and you feel a disconnect, you're really detecting the flatness of that person's face, a lack of prosody in the voice, and often they're speaking in a monotone. And in our culture, we try to emphasize that it's the content of what we're saying. But our body says something different. Our body says we care less about the content, about how, and more about how it's being projected. So if you use prosodic voices, you can say lots of things. You can move topics, you get into harder constructs than if you talk in a monotone. And those of us who experience college understand this. So we've gone through that.
In terms of the old vagus and the new vagus nerve, I've heard these two described with lots of different terms.
Yeah.
So I've heard the old vagus described as dorsal and the new vagus as ventral, and other terms as well. And I'm curious if you could go through these different terms and which ones you like and don't like.
Well, as you probably know, all the terms kind of evolved from talks I gave or things I wrote. So I initially started talking, I talked about what I called the smart vagus and the vegetative vagus. Smart vagus being the vagus that was linked to the face and myelinated, linked to the heart and lungs, and the vegetative vagus as being more linked to subdiaphragmatic organs and also vulnerable for that defensive shutting down. Then I changed the term and I called it the mammalian vagus versus a reptilian? No, I never called it reptilian. So I may have called it a myelinated vagus versus an unmyelinated. And that's because the vagal pathways to the heart are predominantly myelinated, and the ones to the bronchi within the lungs are myelinated. But the vagal pathways below the diaphragm are not myelinated. Now, there's an important point here, because myelin is an insulator. It's a fatty substance that is wrapped around the neural fiber. And myelinated fibers are just faster, more efficient, more tightly regulated. So we do much better regulating above our diaphragm than we do below our diaphragm. So below our diaphragm is more diffuse, more, if we have problems there, it kind of manifests itself in many organs. What will, to many listeners, they'll be familiar with gut problems, and they'll talk about it as anxiety. But the term dorsal and ventral now really come to the area in the brainstem where the two different pathways of the vagus are actually where they originate. And the dorsal one is the original one. It's the original old vertebrate way. And when we look at embryology and we look at what happens as the embryo develops and as we start getting fetal development, we start seeing that the cells of origin, the cells that would go to the heart, move in the brainstem ventrally from the dorsal motor nucleus to another nucleus called nucleus ambiguous. I hate to bring those names in, but the point is that nucleus ambiguous is the area of the brainstem that's regulating the muscles of the face and head. So it's not that nucleus ambiguous is actually regulating more of laryngeal and pharyngeal, but it's interacting with the nucleus of the facial nerve and the nucleus for the trigeminal nerve. It's a column in the brainstem regulating all the striated muscles, and they get linked to this myelinated vagus. So what we see in reality is that when people try to calm down, try to recruit this calming myelinated vagus, they use the structures of the face. So they vocalize, they talk, they smile, they sing, they do breathing exercises, and sometimes they just listen. And all those are recruiting neural pathways that interact with that new vagal circuit, and they're calming.
Okay, so you mentioned, and you said I hate to mention, but now I have to pick up on it, nucleus ambiguous. I mean, would why is it called nucleus ambiguous?
Well, first of all, anatomists have fun. I mean, it's their sense of humor. Okay, nucleus ambiguous means ambiguous nucleus because the boundaries were not that set. And it's part of a column in the brainstem where all the ancient nerves that regulate the structures of the ancient gill arches of fish and earlier vertebrae emerge. So when we think of cranial nerves, we think of them as having duties or responsibilities. We forget that they come from areas. So the brainstem area that controls all the striated muscles of the face and head is an area that interacts with nucleus ambiguous, and that interacts with that myelinated vagal pathway. Now, if you want to play with words, vagus means vagabond or wanderer, and that's exactly what's happening with the vagal pathways. They wander throughout the whole body with reaching most of our visceral organs.
Well, and while we're with language for a moment, the polyvagal theory, when you went to name the theory, it occurred to me that you could have called it something like the two vagus theory, but that you use this word poly intentionally for some reason, and I'd like to understand that.
I use it very intentionally because I wasn't going to lock myself. You know, when you start discovering things and you realize there are two different vagal circuits, maybe there are three. So you want to create what the name was to create the opportunity to have expansion of the theory and to emphasize that the theory was based on the evolution of these structures. And the poly was to really also put into play that there's a sensory part of the vagus, which has totally been neglected in medicine and, of course, in psychology. And so that became literally a third branch. So you have two motor pathways and you have a primary sensory pathway. So, or you could say you really have four vagal pathways because you have two motor and two sensory. And how it's organized in the brainstem is really the interesting question, because that's where the communication comes and that's how it interferes or affects or influences our ability to relate to the world.
Okay, in describing your work in the neonatal world, you talked about how we respond with the newest development first, how as a human being we'll respond with this new vagus first. And I wanted to understand more why that is. Why, I mean, if we have all these different capacities, why might we not respond with the oldest part of ourselves first? I mean, heck, it's the oldest.
Some people do. Let's go through this for a moment. Let's talk about the high-risk preterm baby whose newer vagal circuit isn't there. So they're left to responding with the next level of autonomic evolution, the next newest, which happens to be the sympathetic nervous system that supports fight-flight behaviors. And when that doesn't serve to put the body or the nervous system in a state of safety, then it will recruit the oldest circuit. Now, why is your real question? And I'm going to bring you back to another a philosopher and then a neurologist. So Darwin in the 1800s came up with the theory of evolution. But a UK philosopher by the name of John Herbert Spencer was very intrigued with the concept of evolution. And he proposed a philosophical concept that he called dissolution or evolution in reverse. And this was picked up by a neurologist at about the turn of the 20th century. And the neurologist was John Hewlings Jackson. And he talked about dissolution as a principle of the nervous system. So but he was focusing on the brain. And he was focusing on head injury and brain diseases. And that what he was saying is that when you injure the brain, you start uncovering older layers of reactivity. And many of your listeners may have heard of Phineas Gage. He was an individual who was at a pipe that went right through his prefrontal cortex. It disinhibited many of his behaviors. So what we have to understand is that higher levels of our brain actually are actively inhibiting lower levels of the brain. So when I developed the theory, there was a second part of the title, which I can't even, you know, I wouldn't know it totally, but it was about orienting in a defensive world. And it was mammalian. It was about how we dealt with our evolutionary heritage. How were we able to turn off our defenses to be able to become connected? And many listeners will be asking, will be thinking about this, because many of their clients or many of them want to have relationships, but they don't know how to turn off their defenses. And it's not a voluntary turning off. It's actually the brain has to detect safety to turn off defense. And this gets into a whole nother metaphor. And the metaphor is that feeling safe is not the same thing as removing threat. We need cues of safety. And so certain types of vocalizations, like intonation of voice, gesture, are ways of cueing our nervous system that the intentionality of the other is good, so they can turn off their defenses. So if the voice is barking or yelling and there's a shrinkage of the upper part of the face, so all you're seeing is the jaw. So just think of Alec Baldwin when he does the Trump impersonation. He's just all using the emphasis on the mouth, because in doing that, he's making everyone look down here. And that's where aggressive vocalizations occur. Sounds of safety and facial expressions of safety occur at the upper part of the face, subtle in terms of the orbital muscle called the orbicularis oculi. This muscle, which many people go to get Botox treatment on because it takes away the crow's feet, but the crow's feet are cues to the other's nervous system that that person is in a good mood, happy.
Steve, I'm going to sneak in a question that's come in from one of our listeners that we're connected to, and I imagine there might be other people in her situation. It's Evelyn, and she writes in, "Our daughter was born 31 years ago at 26 weeks. Yeah. She has a lot of anxiety, even though we bonded well. Yeah. Do you have any suggestions to strengthen her sense of safety and trust?"
Well, let's start off by saying that her experiences are common. They're not uncommon. So a lot of parents of preterm babies have children who have done extraordinarily well. They've done what, gone to college, got graduate degrees, do well cognitively, but have difficulty creating relationships. And this, some of the symptomatology may be viewed as anxiety, and some of it may be just, you know, use other psychological words like fear and or trepidation, whatever term you want. But what Evelyn is saying is that her child doesn't have the resources to utilize this new myelinated vagal circuit to downregulate these defenses. And now what the question you're asking is, how do you build on that? How do you take that as a hint to build now techniques that improve that myelinated vagal regulation of basically downregulating the sympathetic defenses, which are the physiological underlying of anxiety? And the answer is through some tricks or knowledge of the neurophysiology. We know that certain types of breathing patterns turn on and off the vagus. And this becomes very intuitive to many people, because when you're anxious, you take longer inspirations and shorter expirations. And shorter expirations. And what that does is it turns on off that myelinated vagus even more to allow that sympathetic nervous system to activate itself and become manifested as anxiety. But if you shift the ratio, if you start to exhale with longer durations, the vagal input on the heart starts to calm you down. And what we see, or you'll see if you with many people, is that they know this. So they'll like to sing, or they'll play musical instruments, or some of them will even just sit there and listen and breathe with the music. So lots of breathing patterns, whether we go towards yoga or other technologies, emphasize the power of slow exhalations, because that turns on that vagal inhibition that calms you down. That's the myelinated vagus. And respiratory therapies that even emphasize abdominal breathing amplify that effect, because the sensory signals from the diaphragm are powerful in enhancing that vagal activity. But if you want to get yourself anxious, you know, to reverse it, meaning longer inspirations and shorter expirations. So we can, in a sense, I hate to use this word, but people use it in the culture today, we can hack our nervous system by knowing the power of what breathing does to those vagal pathways. And we can basically recruit them.
So, Steve, I think emphasizing the exhalation, that's something that is very understandable. I get that completely. But you said one thing that I didn't understand that I'd like to understand, that when we do this, this turns on vagal inhibition. So I'm a little confused about whether or not I want to activate the vagal system or I want to turn on vagal inhibition. I'm confused.
Very good question. So we need a little bit more information. So let's go to our heart. Take the heart as this organ and go to its pacemaker, the sinoatrial atrial node. If there were no neural influence to the heart, our heart would be beating between 90 and 120 beats per minute, depending on the size of our bodies or our hearts. But most of our heart rates are much slower than that. And that's because the vagus acts as a brake. It inhibits the pacemaker. It slows the heart up. And this has many adaptive functions. It means we can get more cardiac output, get our heart rate up, by merely taking that vagal brake off. And then if we're well regulated and we sit down and calm down, the brake goes back on. So when we're talking about the word vagal inhibition, I'm talking about the power of the vagus in slowing the pacemaker up. So the effect of the vagus on the pacemaker is amplified during exhalation and minimized during inhalation.
Now, I want to just continue to unpack the map, if you will, of the polyvagal theory, because I think many of us, at least this was my experience if I track back to when I was in high school, who are introduced to what is the autonomic nervous system, were taught that we have a sympathetic and a parasympathetic nervous system. So how does the polyvagal theory upgrade, if you will, this old understanding?
Okay, the old model that was presented was a model of paired antagonism. The sympathetic was your accelerator, the parasympathetic was your calmer or your brake. It was never described in terms of defense systems or adaptive reactions. So parasympathetic, the major component of the parasympathetic nervous system is the vagus. So let's start off there. I seldom use the word parasympathetic because it's so vague to me. I use the vagus because it's a cranial nerve and we can see and evaluate that. So most of the parasympathetic nervous system is the vagus. So the models that we were taught were models of paired antagonism, which implied that most organs were receiving constant input from both subsystems of the autonomic nervous system. That is in part correct. The real issue is, how does our autonomic nervous system react to challenges? It does not react in a paired way. It reacts hierarchically. It reacts hierarchically following the rule of evolution in reverse. So we use our newest circuit, our next circuit, and then our last circuit, our oldest one. And these are functionally wired into our body in our quest for survival. So you're going to have to ask some more questions to unpack that.
Okay. One of the things that I was reading was how much emphasis you place on the evolutionary step that happened when we reptiles became mammals, and that this was hugely important, and that to understand our nervous system today, we have to really understand that evolutionary step. So I'd love to know why you place such a great importance on that. And what is it that we need to understand?
We need to understand that the bodies of mammals, and we are mammals, have to be in a safe physiological state to interact with each other. We have to respect that. Doesn't mean we have to be in that state all the time, but we have to have the resource to be able to go into that state. So this is really, let's take a look at a playful situation where we are mobilized, using our social engagement system, functionally duplicating fight-flight behaviors. But what makes fight-flight behaviors different from play is that we use our social engagement system, which are those muscles of the face and head, that gives us voice, gives us facial expressivity, and enables us to convey intention. And when we convey that intention through those mechanisms, we are also regulating that vagal inhibition of the sympathetics. So we're keeping our system contained so that we're going back and forth between a sympathetic mobilization and this vagal system that is calming us down, cueing us into safety. And if we can't cue ourselves into safety, we have fights. And this is the playground.
So a different way to maybe get at some of what you're saying is, what do you see as the goal, if you will, of a healthy nervous system? I have a healthy relationship to my nervous system. Each one of these three systems does what it's supposed to do. What would that look like?
Okay, what it would look like that you would have a prosodic voice. You would use other individuals to help you regulate your physiological state so you would be connected with others. So that if you felt anxious or uncomfortable or scared, you could come with the resource of another person. You could co-regulate. Now, if you're under a demand, let's say it's important for your body to mobilize, to get somewhere or run away or fight someone off, that myelinated New Vagus would be withdrawn until you got yourself into a safe place, and then it would come back. Now, here is the real issue, and this is why it's critical to many people who have experienced trauma. Some of the trauma, or many of the features of the trauma, have to do with physical restraint and the inability to mobilize sufficiently to avoid the predator, avoid the person who would be hurting them. And under those situations, the body may automatically shift into this very old defensive system, which is to pass out, potentially to defecate. And if this goes on multiple times, or let's say it occurs the system gets triggered less severely, it might merely be the person dissociates, they leave the place psychologically, their faces go blank, and they don't feel their body. So people who are the survivors of sexual violence often have experiences following that of body numbness. They often are vulnerable to dissociative states, and they often will do highly mobilized, because as long as they stay mobilized, they can't shut down. So it's a hierarchy. So if you mobilize, you can't shut down. But if you shut down, it's like the worst thing that could ever happen, because you're no longer an interactive human being.
So using this theoretical map here, using the lens of the polyvagal theory, what are the implications for therapists who are working with people who have suffered from the kind of trauma you're describing?
Well, there are several points here. One is to be a witness of the person, and that is not to cast any evaluation of the event, because in the evaluation of a person who shut down can only, if you say, why did you fight, why are you better, you have everything to live for, is not witnessing the individual, because the individual experienced something and they want to be witnessed. So that's the first one, is the witnessing of the client. The second one is, although I've been emphasizing face-to-face, vocalization, interaction, when people have experienced severe trauma, when someone gives them facial expressivity, it goes into their space, it's a threat to them, because their nervous system is so biased towards defense that they're not picking up the features of engagement. So under those situations, the portal that is the most effective one is the acoustic portal, vocalizations. Our body has great difficulty turning off prosodic voice, the intonation of voice. The metaphors that I use are, what does a mother do to a crying baby? The mother uses a prosodic voice. And then I juxtapose that to, what do fathers do when the baby cries? Mothers are much more natural than that. But then if I talk about how do you deal with your puppy or your dog, then males and females seem to do the same. They use a baby-like voice because the intonation of the voice to those other mammals has the same effect of conveying cues of safety. So we have to understand that our nervous system is wired to detect cues of safety through a vocal, through an acoustic channel.
Now, I want to make sure that prosodic voice is very real, both for me and for everybody who's watching this. So I notice I want to make sure that I'm talking in a very prosodic voice. Am I going to have a few more ups and downs in my voice than I might normally? I mean, it's a little awkward trying it on is what I'm getting at here. And I wonder what your instructions or suggestions might be for someone who's trying to develop more prosody in their voice.
Well, that's an interesting question. So I now have to tell you a story that was told to me. And the story was about Bill Clinton when he was president, and the Republicans used to come meet with him. And you remember Clinton, when he was president, had a very, very prosodic and sing-songy voice. To me, it was a little too much in terms of an exaggerated sing-songy voice. And they used to leave the meetings with him feeling very good, but not remembering what they agreed to. So I use that as a kind of an interesting segue into the power of vocalizations. I think the so-called sweet talking has an impact. The part is we want to be true to what we really want to convey, and that's really what you're saying, that you don't want to overdo it. You want to use the intonation of the voice to convey the parts. You don't want to overdo it. And talk in the wrong way. And we often see this with newscasters who start using very prosodic voices, but they're using it to describe horrible situations. And then we feel, you know, it makes us feel very bad. So prosody, from my bias, is really the prosody of conveying more positive affective states. Although prosody, the operational definition, is really emotion being conveyed in voice. For me, it's the conveyance of more positive attributes for calming and recruiting the autonomic nervous system.
Okay, in terms of, once again, a therapist working with people who have suffered trauma and helping them feel safe, I get witnessing, validating their experience, using the voice, but it seems like more is going to be needed here for healing to really come online through the lens of the polyvagal theory?
Well, the polyvagal theory is a starting point, and I start to describe in some of the papers I've been writing what I call a passive pathway and an active pathway. The passive pathway is really what are the cues you can give the nervous system, cues of safety, so that the physiological state moves to a state in which things can be done, active work could be done. So you're not going to do therapy, you're not going to do any form of therapy if the person's physiological state is too reactive. So you need to leverage an understanding of physiological state and try to move that state to a more safe or comfortable state. And that's where I was going with prosodic voice, background sounds, female vocal music. Now, when you start getting really into deeper aspects of therapy, you're dealing really with an active pathway. And that active pathway is where the work is being done. What do I mean by an active pathway? An active pathway is where you move the individual's physiological state through whatever dialogue you use from a safe to a less safe, but enabling the client to have a resource to get back to the safe. So what you're doing is providing this opportunity to experience a physiological state that was more chaotic or disruptive, but you're now enabling that individual to either self-regulate or co-regulate with a therapist to move back to a calmer state. And the other term I use is, if you try to deconstruct all the therapies that have been used for trauma, you start seeing some common themes. And the first theme is that there's kind of respect for the implicit body, the body's feelings, the body's responses. But it's not an empowerment of the implicit feelings, because that could be unbounded. It's a containment of the implicit feelings with some type of explicit model, which means I go and I experience it, but I know where I can come back and be safe. I think this process of going in and out of those states is what therapy is about.
One thing I think is interesting is that as we're talking, I hear some truck backing up, making sounds, which is, of course, interesting. That's happening somewhere in your environment. But, you know, it signals me I'm in and out of safety. Now the sound has gone away. I feel okay.
When it was I'm on a campus, and campuses, they are doing some construction. And this, to me, I've been on campuses for decades, and what I've always been amazed is the disrespect for the physical presence of people trying to learn or do their work. I also have felt that within the hospital. How could you have hospitals that were so noisy when the body is trying to be safe and be healthy? Because what I've always said is the neural circuits that are involved in feeling safe and in social behavior are the same neural circuits that enable us to heal and to restore ourselves. So there's a contradiction in how we treat human beings.
Mm-hmm. Just interesting following up on that. How would you redesign the hospital so that people would feel more safe?
I would redesign schools as well. Hospitals have been designed for cleanliness, which is important, and surveillance, which is important. But they haven't dealt with the acoustic features that trigger feelings of safety or fear. Remember, I said that I was emphasizing the cues and the vocalizations of voice as cues of safety. But low-frequency sounds are wired into our nervous system as predator sounds. We can't help but react to those. That's who we are.
Mm-hmm. And how would you redesign schools while we're at it?
Oh, to do that is to get rid of the low-frequency sounds. And that means we have to be very careful about the mechanicals in buildings, meaning the ventilation systems, which have a lot of low-frequency sounds, and we need to make sure they're not there. I designed the School for Autism when I was at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and I worked with the architects to reduce low-frequency sounds. And I even worked with the fire commissioner to change the fire alarm so it played Stars and Stripes Forever. It didn't have the noisy sounds that the kids are so fearful of. Because when the fire alarms would go off, the kids would freeze. They couldn't move. They were moving them into this shutting down response without an understanding of their physiology. So, again, if we think in terms of hospitals, even the isolettes where preterm babies are put in, they're often very noisy. And there was a concern about damage to the ears. That's just one concern. The other concern is, what does it do to their physiological state? Does it enable them to efficiently grow, or does it compromise that?
You know, interestingly, you've been talking a lot about the sound of the voice and how that relates to this new vagus nerve. But now you're talking about listening, how we receive sound. And I wonder if you can just help me understand that from a physiological perspective and what's happening in terms of the reception of sound in the body.
Now, listening is both a receptive and a motor response, and we forget about the motor component. So we send sounds into our ear. The sounds go up through the middle ear structures to the inner ear and then up the auditory nerve to the auditory cortex. But there's feedback from that. So if the sounds are melodic, like a human voice, the feedback comes back and says we're in a safe place functionally. Let's tense those muscles up and let's focus on human voice. And that's what that feedback does through tensing the nerves that regulate the middle ear muscles, which happen to be a branch of the facial nerve and a branch of the trigeminal. So when people have flat faces, and you see this after people have been scared or frightened, they often, the neural tone to the middle ear is often very downregulated, so they're hypersensitive to low-frequency sounds, meaning that they can't hear human voice and background noise. So they don't go to bars, they don't go to restaurants, they don't go to shopping malls, because the background sound is overwhelming and they can't hear what people are saying.
Steve, we have a question here that's come in that I'm going to bring into our conversation. I think it's something you know quite a lot about. Linda writes in, one of the hallmarks of autistic persons is a lack of prosody in the voice. Yeah. They also have difficulty interpreting non-verbal cues in others. How does the polyvagal theory explain autistic development, and how can it help those who are on the spectrum?
Well, actually, I spent about 20 years working with autistic children, and I'm starting now working with Prader-Willi syndrome, which is a developmental disability that has some of the features, and I also work with Fragile X, which is another genetic disorder. They all seem to have some common features of this social engagement system being downregulated. So let me explain what the social engagement system is. The social engagement system is this linkage between the neural regulation of the muscles, the striated muscles of the face and head, and that vagal regulation of the heart, the myelinated vagus. So we have a social engagement system that uses faces and voices and listens, and that's linked to physiological state. Now, when we deal with any type of clinical population, whether it's autism or Prader-Willi, or even people with high anxiety, we will see that the neural regulation of the face is downregulated, the neural regulation of the middle ear muscles is downregulated, so there's hypersensitivity to sounds, but often difficulty in hearing human voice, and the intonation of voice is going to lack prosody, is going to be more expressed as variations in loudness. So people are going to talk louder and modulate loudness and not modulate the frequency. So when when Linda discussed her child with autism, the child is speaking loudly and trying to emphasize words by loudness without the ability to modulate intonation of voice, because the neural regulation of intonation is through that cluster that is part of that social engagement system. So that system is downregulated. So we have actually worked on that with autistic kids, where we presented to them acoustic stimuli that were amplified modulations of female vocal voices. So we tried to, in a sense, amplify the cues that were wired into the nervous system. And in approximately 60% of the children who had auditory hypersensitivities, we were able to take that away. That was gone. And a lot more spontaneous social behavior emerged. So that was part of what I was trying to do by saying, if this system is downregulated, it doesn't mean that it is destroyed or it's not there. Let's assume that there's a physiological state that that nervous system is in, and can we now change that state by giving it cues of safety? And that's what I was doing with my work.
Now, Steve, we were talking about trauma and talking about the polyvagal theory and how it applies for therapists. And one of the things I read is that you're actually working on a new quote-unquote prescription, if you will, for people who have experienced some kind of acute trauma and a way that they can respond more effectively through applying the wisdom of the polyvagal theory. What is this prescription?
Well, no, it's not there yet, but I'm working on it. Okay, so I'm very, very interested in the effects of acute trauma, an identifiable traumatic event that does something so profound that the person is different the day after, or let's say a week after. It's not the question, it's how they reacted, that it has some features of a one trial learning task. So it becomes something similar to what was known as when there was a research in taste aversion. So when people were getting chemotherapy, they often could no longer eat the foods they had eaten before they had the therapy. Trauma may follow, acute trauma may follow some of these same principles. And if you know those principles, you can get hints about what they did with a taste aversion. So we start seeing that that there may be other ways of getting to it. I don't have to. So let me simply say I'm working on that. I don't have the answers yet.
Share with us, though, a little bit of the principles that you're working with and some clues that you have about what might go into this.
Well, I don't. The first part is I wanted to create an animal model of an acute immobilization that's very similar to what happens to human beings. I want to have animals that went into a severe bradycardia, where their heart rates, in a sense, their bodies went into a shutdown, where they were no longer struggling. I want to create that model and then to figure out how I could rehabilitate that. And the mechanisms of rehabilitation that I would be thinking about would be, one, on one side, cues of safety that we've been talking about, but on another side, cues from the subdiaphragmatic area below the diaphragm that may send information up to the brain that the body's okay. I think that trauma is functionally, a lot of it, let me back off for a moment and basically say, let's forget the word trauma and let's focus on the response, because events have people respond in many, many different ways. But the event is not the critical point. The critical point is, what did the body do? So if we focus on the fact that sometimes people's bodies shut down to events and some other people with the same events do fine, we don't want to blame the individual for their body's responses. What we want to do is understand the mechanisms through which their body reacted. So in this case, I would start thinking about how one could change the feedback from the subdiaphragmatic areas. And that may result in some type of pharmacological blockade, and nothing very, very dangerous, but in a sense, changing the cues from the gut. So people who have trauma, who have experienced trauma, often have a trauma gut, meaning they have irritable bowel syndrome, they have other types of issues with their gut. Now, if we can change the feedback from the gut to the brain and then use cues of safety, maybe we can reverse some of these things. So that, you know, it's all speculative now, and that's where I'm thinking. And what I've been very concerned about is the lack of knowledge in terms of a real model of how the feedback from those subdiaphragmatic organs results in these different mental health disorders, including diagnoses such as fibromyalgia, dysautonomia, and irritable bowel.
Okay. Now, Stephen, you coined a term. You've coined many terms. It's pretty cool to coin terms and get them then included in the literature moving forward, called the term I'm referring to here is neuroception, which is our ability to assess danger, if I understand that correctly.
Right. Actually, I think neuroception is really what's important to us as individuals. Neuroception is how our bodies really detect, our nervous system detects and evaluates risk in the environment. I was struggling with this because I would have liked to have used a word like perception. Do you perceive risk? Well, once you use the word perception, you're inserting a cognitive, voluntary, volitional component. And then you start saying, well, I missed it. I didn't detect risk. And now you start blaming victims. I wanted to do something different. I wanted to kind of explain that our body reacts to features in the environment long before we are aware of them. We respond to stuff. We respond. And often we don't know what we're responding to, but we are usually quite aware of our bodily responses to it. The example is someone, you may be talking to someone and you ask them a question and they turn their body away and they walk away from you. And you get this bodily reaction. Now, you might think that the person, you might create a narrative that the person's not interested in you or the person doesn't like you. But in reality, it was the disconnect that the body did, that other person did, that triggered this physiological response. And I do some of these exercises in lectures and workshops that I do to experienced clinicians, and some of them are totally amazed at their bodily reactions to very overt behaviors. So neuroception was a word I had to come up with to deal with how our body reacts to changes in the world and evaluates that risk. And it had to be fast. The system had to be automatic. It had to detect the intentionality of bodily movement, of voice, of facial expressivity and gesture. And if it weren't quick, as a species, we would not have survived. We'd be still arguing whether it was really risky or not.
So I want to take a situation now that I think most of us are familiar with, which is we suddenly find ourselves feeling anxious about something. We don't feel safe anymore. We don't even know why exactly, but our stomach is fluttering. Maybe our hands are sweating in some way. And from this conversation, we think, I want to move back into safety.
Yeah.
You know, Stephen said I could emphasize the exhale. That's good. What else can I do? I want to move back into safety, and I feel a little freaked out, and I don't even know why.
Okay. So some people listen to music. So they listen to not rap music. They listen to ballads or female vocalizations. Folk songs were very useful. You know, even love ballads are using that vocalization to make us feel safe and comfortable. So we can listen. The rules that I basically follow are, first, remove the sounds of predator, remove the background sounds, remove the sounds of danger, get them out of your environment. Now, that's the same thing as saying removing threat. And when we remove threat, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to be safe. So the threat removal is the first step. But now, once we remove threat, we want to start putting something into the system. And putting something into the system is going to be through acoustic information. And we can put more into that system by using our breathing patterns. So if we start changing how we breathe to longer exhalations. One metaphor on that is if we extend the duration of our phrases to use more words before we take a breath, we are calming ourselves down.
All right. I'm going to now speak quite slowly as I ask.
No, just add more words to your phrases.
More words. Okay, wow, this is going to go on and on. I think I'll get to the point, though. Safety and the social engagement system. I get that, I think, and how they're connected. At the same time, earlier you talked a little bit about play and how we could be engaged with another person and yet we're playing a competitive sport.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's interesting. That now I have the social engagement systems involved, but I'm in a different part of my nervous system.
Well, you're bringing up something very important. Let's move back to neuroception first. And with neuroception, we are basically detecting safety, danger, or life threat. And those are the three, it's going to recruit three different components of our autonomic nervous system. Safety will enable more social engagement. Danger will create more sympathetic mobilization. And life threat is going to shut us down. Okay? So we have those three circuits, but that's not the world we want to live in. We don't want to either be safe. We don't just want to be in danger. We don't want to be in life threat. We want to use all the components of our autonomic nervous system, but we want to use it in a safe space. So we talked about play, which is now using the sympathetics and the social engagement. So we're moving, but we're social referencing, and that enables us to reinterpret the mobilization. So if you have watched dogs playing, dogs will chase each other. They're not making face-to-face contact. They'll chase each other. But what happens when they make contact, like bite the rear leg? Then the face of the dog that's been bitten turns towards the face of the dog that chased them. And that face-to-face is really the way that the aggressiveness is diffused. And then they roll reverse and chase each other. The one that was being chased chases the one that was the chaser. And that's the way we play. We have role reversal, and we maintain face-to-face interactions to diffuse cues of movement to make sure that they are not intend to injure us. And we watch dogs play, we learn a lot. We watch kittens play, we learn a lot. And if we watch children play, we learn a lot. And we can watch that many children who have challenged social engagement systems are not welcomed into play circles. They are marginalized because they don't play well, meaning they don't have good reciprocity. They're not aware of the other. Now, we also can recruit that older dorsal vagal circuit with safety. And what do we call that? We call that intimacy, the ability to be safe in the arms of another. And when we're in that state, our whole body is safe. We can be touched anywhere. And if we're just being held together in safety in that state, then our physiology efficiently supports health growth and restoration.
So this is really interesting. If I understand you correctly, you're saying we can be connected to other people. The social engagement system can be on in all three different nervous system states.
Right. So if we talk about intimacy, what have we done? We have given up face-to-face, but we use a little bit of voice, a little bit of gesture, to that intentionality is good. But remember, with people who have various histories who aren't safe with others, the loss of face-to-face contact can really upset them.
Now, there are other areas I want to apply the polyvagal theory to, but I just want to take a moment. The sounds, the disruptive sounds, I'm very sound sensitive, in the background of where you are, whether it was the knocking or the truck backing up and beeping, they're gone. But while they were happening, and I feel so much better, I thought, oh, it's just so interesting. Here we are. We're in the middle of this live broadcast.
So this is great that you can leverage something that I felt was disruptive to the message and make it the message. Very well done. So this is good. I don't like that either. So I have to work harder in staying engaged because I view them as, so the high pitch one are cues of danger. The lower pitch, whether it's tapping or truck sounds, are predator sounds, and they're working with the body. And I'm using my social engagement system to keep me on target, keeping my voice prosodic and my engagement. But, you know, it can be challenging. But you can see that we have a degree of flexibility to deal with that.
Right, and that's what I thought was interesting, was that here you and I are both challenged, but we're doing it.
Yeah.
And could you say we're calling on certain skills that we've developed that recruit the new vagus to help us? Or because I think a lot of people feel bothered a lot of the time and they have to stay calm and collected.
I think rather than using the word skill, let's say resource. And let's say we know we have a resource that so we don't get too upset by this because we know we have a resource. That resource may be a skill, but it's a resource that enables us to keep our physiological state contained. When I use the word contained, I mean not being reactive, not being into a fight flight, and not shutting down. We're containing it, and we know we can contain it. And that's, again, if we get into issues of therapy for whether it's stress disorders or mental health disorders, we really want to know, do we have the resource on board on ourselves that we can contain our urges to go out and get rid of the driver or the tapper?
Mm-hmm. Now, talk a little bit about chronic stress and what the polyvagal theory allows us to understand about healing from chronic stress.
Well, again, first of all, I'm not a big fan of the word stress. I'd much rather talk in terms of the operations of what the body is doing. Because when we use the word stress, we again get confused between stimulus and response. We don't know what's causing it, and we don't know whether we're calling stress our own response, or are we causing it, labeling it in terms of what's going on in the environment. I am more comfortable by saying that there are challenges in the environment that recruit certain aspects of our nervous system. And some of those aspects of the nervous system are mobilization systems, systems that support what we call fight or flight behaviors. If we are chronically recruiting those, we are interfering with our body's need for regeneration, for health growth and restoration. And to do that, we need that parasympathetic system. We need both vagal circuits have to be working in a supportive way and out of defense. And what I had kind of left out of the dialogue is a real agenda in life is not to recruit our autonomic nervous system in defense. Because when we recruit it in defense, we don't have that resource. We don't have the social engagement system. And when we recruit the autonomic nervous system in defense for too long a period of time, then we have a degrading of our health. Because the circuits that are now recuperative are inhibited by the sympathetic activity. Now, I'm going to unpack that in a different way. I'm going to remind you about something that may have happened in your life when you were younger. When you were younger and you wanted to go swimming after lunch, what did your mother say?
You don't remember? Yeah, of course I do. Don't do it. You'll drown. Something like that. Basically, off limits for 45 minutes.
Right. Depending on what culture you're from, it could go up to an hour or 2 hours. But the issue I always ask is, how did your mother know about the polyvagal theory? Because it's a perfect example of the polyvagal theory. What your mother was saying, that if you mobilize, go swimming, you're going to inhibit the digestion, the subdiaphragmatic areas, and that's going to cause cramps and you're going to die. Okay? Now, I'm going to tell you something, the converse of that. If you have suffered severe trauma experiences and you don't like the feelings of being traumatized, which no one likes, people will often highly mobilize themselves. They'll do risky behaviors. They'll stay highly active because any of the cues of calming down are now going to be cues of shutting down. So they also know intuitively the hierarchy. As long as you keep moving, you turn off the subdiaphragmatic vagus. Your mother knew that, and that's the intuition of many people with trauma histories. Keep moving, don't experience a subdiaphragmatic area. But when you keep moving and don't support your subdiaphragmatic area, what do you end up getting? All kinds of disorders below the diaphragm.
Now, I want to take a moment now and reach out to our listeners and let you know that if you have a question about applying the polyvagal theory to some aspect of life, this is your chance to write in that dialogue box, hit submit, and your question will come to me here in the Sounds True studio. In terms of health, I'd love to know more about the connection between getting a good night's sleep and how we can work successfully with our vagus system.
Okay, so for me, and my interpretation is sleep regulation is really an autonomic response. So if our autonomic nervous system is organized and well regulated, we sleep well. We have good sleep patterns. So it's kind of like you think of sleep patterns as the foundation upon which the autonomic nervous system regulates. So I think this is very important. I also want to alert many of the listeners do, that people who don't sleep, this is not a good symptom. And there are many people in our society who claim they don't need to sleep. And the part that we start learning is lack of sleep also becomes one of the symptoms of trauma histories. So we need to understand that the body needs to go through sleep cycles. It needs sleep for its responsibility to maintain its health.
Okay, we have a question here that's come in that says, are recordings of guided meditations with soothing music, prosodic voices, and affirmations helpful in restoring polyvagal tone and changing behavior when played during sleep, when played while awake? I'm going to use a lot of words here. Is listening
well,
to self-hypnosis
I don't know about played
tapes
during
harmful?
Sleep. I don't know. I think the issue is, okay, so I think if you're awake and listening to literally guided imagery or prosodic voices with background music, that this supports the polyvagal state of the social engagement system protective. I don't know what it will do during sleep. I have no idea. And I don't know if it's detrimental to do it during sleep, but I can't think of anything that would be detrimental about doing during waking hours.
Okay. Mark writes in, what determines the threshold of how long we can keep calm when upsets are around?
Well, I think this is a wonderful question. And let's go back to my kind of introductory statement where I talked about SOR models, or stimulus organismic state response models, where physiological state is really the mediator of how we react to stimuli. So to Mark's question, our threshold to be reactive, or the duration in which we can tolerate certain things, is probably related to our current physiological state. And that physiological state is not a fixed one. It's not, in a sense, a biomarker that doesn't change with time of day or with experience or what occurred 15 or 20 minutes before. It's a dynamically moving physiological measure that is preparing us to be reactive or less reactive.
Now, one thing I'm curious about, Stephen, is how you've applied the polyvagal theory to relationships, intimate relationships. I'd love to know, if you would, even from your own life, how you've used the theory and how it works or doesn't work.
Well, I've actually, since I'm now part of the Kinsey Institute, and my wife is Sue Carter, the woman who discovered, the scientist who discovered the relationship between oxytocin and social behavior, that discussions have shifted about social behavior and actually focusing on literally sexual violence, and this, both sexual violence and also my current interest, or one of my interests, is in what happens with subdiaphragmatic surgeries. What happens when you tamper with the area of the body below the diaphragm? What's the cues going back to the brain in terms of the ability to be intimate in relationships? So to kind of get back to your question, I'm very interested in the disruptiveness or difficulties in creating relationships. So let's go back to the woman who mentioned her preterm baby, who's now 31 years old, I believe.
Yes.
And I think the issue with many of the preterm infants who are now in their 20s and 30s, that parents have contacted me, and many of them are parents, many of the parents are professionals who are clinicians, basically always report the same scenario, that the child has done very well intellectually but has difficulty reading the cues of others and creating relationships. So in my modeling, the first part of trying to help a relationship develop is to understand the power of cues, meaning neuroception. So in relationships, the cues are shifting the physiological state of the other. And in relationships, what do you want? You want the other person to feel safe with you. And how do you do that? Do you say, be safe with me? Or do you talk in a different way? Are you, in a sense, gentle and humorous and engaging and reciprocal? Are you turning away from the person? When the person looks at you, you turn away. It creates a disruptive, what I call a violation of neural expectancy, which makes our body feel disrespected, or it's a rude behavior, but our body feels like it was not respected. We need to understand how our body interprets basic cues. And when we understand that, we can actually start functionally charting out how relationships work. And when they don't work, what are the issues? We all know that when people get very anxious, they become less caring to each other. And we can understand that calming or providing an individual to help the anxious person regulate is very important. So we need to understand that we need to develop a resource to calm our own behavior. And we hopefully will learn that co-regulation with a significant other is the way, the optimal way to regulate. And that's the way of bonding. That's the way of creating stronger and stronger relationships, co-regulating.
I wonder, Stephen, would you be willing to give me an example from your personal life about when you said, okay, this is a moment and I'm going to actually intentionally invoke some of these cues and let's see what happens?
I think I do well with my children on that.
Okay.
You see, you're pushing now into the personal life. Now,
Just a little.
But the issue is, There's part of this which is very, very powerful, that even when we know what a person turning away or not looking at us can be a expression of their physiological state and that they're anxious, our ability to calm them gets compromised if their behavior makes us feel uncomfortable. So if our body takes it as an insult, I'm not talking about cognitively, I'm talking about our physiology, it may be very difficult to go over that. I think that's why I said I can talk about my children. I'm much more, let's use the term, compassionate and have greater ability to understand their anxieties or their disruptions and to basically be there with them when they go through that. But when we talk about spouses and significant others or peer relationships, I think it's much more difficult, because our bodies respond as if we're being hurt. But when we're parents or mentors, we already have a different role. We know that our role is to be welcoming and supportive. But when we're partners, it's harder. It's harder because our bodies entered the relationship as peers, didn't enter it as one being in charge. And I think there's a danger in being, in a sense, one of the couple that is accepting and the other part of the couple that is not. So in a sense, one has to build a relationship of reciprocity for the relationship to work. And when you deal with your child, the reciprocity is a little bit different. You're not asking something back in terms of calming your own behavior. You're basically satisfied with calming your child's behavior. So that's, I think it's far more doable and leads to stronger family relationships, understanding a child's behavior, especially if you have atypical children. If you have a child like with autism, like the woman mentioned earlier, the child will be less reciprocal. The child will have tantrums. But understanding that is not intentionality, but understanding that as a inefficient method to regulate their own physiological state is fine. It works, it helps. Regarding spouses, I think we need that knowledge, but I think it's much, much harder. I think it's doable, but I think it's harder.
Fair enough. I got a little personal, but not too personal. But we've built a lot of trust here.
But listen, I've been married together for many, many years to the same person. And so, we're doing okay.
All right. Okay, there's a few questions coming in that I'd like to get to from our viewers. Margaret writes in, does polyvagal theory help to explain in any way fibromyalgia symptoms?
I think so. And see, that's what I'm actually working on now, because you see a high comorbidity, meaning that people who have fibromyalgia symptoms often have had trauma histories. And it doesn't make trauma causal, nor does it mean that everyone who has fibromyalgia has had trauma. But the model I'm working on is that some disruption to the subdiaphragmatic, the organs below the diaphragm, are sending signals up to the brain that are interacting with pain pathways. And there's quite a bit of documentation about how the vagus, the sensory vagus, interacts with spinal pain pathways. So the part that I'm working on is to try to deconstruct that and provide an understanding. And from that understanding, we can then start developing different strategies of treatment. And the strategies of treatment that would evolve would be different than what are out there. So the strategy of treatment would be a retraining of neural feedback loops and developing, in a sense, neural exercises of that.
Annie writes in, how can I use this theory to help with a chronic hypersensitive reaction to life?
Take a deep breath and breathe out slowly. Breathe out. So she's saying she's hyperreactive to life?
Hypersensitive.
To life, L-I-F-E, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so what that is saying, when people say that, use that as a description, they're saying that their body is ready to react as if there is a predator in a constant state of defense. And so we have to understand that when people are in that state, their autonomic nervous system is pretty much locked into a sympathetic tone and a down regulation of that social engagement system. So the way of moderating that or reducing that effect is literally to invite the social engagement system back on board. And we would do that through, you know, modulated voices, music, breathing. And the case, what she's describing, is that co-regulation may not be the way to begin with. The person may need to develop a resource of learning how to breathe, to get the vagal system back on, learning to be in a quiet, silent place for a while, to, in a sense, move the body into a place where the sensory information is not great, and get that back to that level before inviting a social engagement behavior to occur, to co-regulate. So there may be a strategy here of learning how to regulate her own body before she can start requesting or interacting with another in a co-regulating state.
Okay, just two final questions here, one from one of our viewers and then a final one from me. Todd writes in, could you address practical approaches to integrate this theory into the treatment of addiction?
Okay, well, let's start off with what is addiction? Addiction is another way of trying to regulate state. So people are taking drugs or doing addictive behaviors to regulate how they feel. So we need to translate this concept of how do I feel into states of the autonomic nervous system. And so once we do that, we start learning how to regulate the autonomic nervous system. So addiction is just one pathway into kind of regulating the autonomic nervous system. And it's a pathway that is not using social behavior or connectedness as the primary regulator. And what you often find, of course, is that people who have severe addictions have difficulty in relationships and in co-regulating with others. So think of addiction as a method of an attempt to regulate physiological state. And that there are other methods, and the methods can be the main method that we're really talking about with polyvagal theory is understanding the hierarchy of the physiological systems, and that if you can recruit that social engagement system to become active, it enables the other components of the autonomic nervous system to be regulated.
And now just a final question. You know, I'm so impressed that you were able to bring a new theory to the world that has so many practical implications. And I guess I'd like to understand a little bit more about what you think of your own inner curiosity, if you will, or inner orientation that allowed that breakthrough and now the work that you're doing now to hopefully generate breakthroughs. You know, what's going on inside of you, Stephen Porges, do you think, that has led to this type of breakthrough work?
Well, There's a lot kind of embedded in the theory, and one of the principles is that humans are a connected species, and that they are, in a sense, in general, good. And they're not aggressive, they're, in a sense, co-regulatory organisms. So there's a very positive philosophical belief embedded in this, and that we have been misled by thinking that survival of the fittest was really based upon aggression, while survival of the fittest was really the fittest to co-regulate and create coalitions and cooperations with others. So there's a deep philosophical component in it. The history of it comes really in part from my own personal journey, and I think this is what you're kind of reaching for. I was actually a clarinetist when I was young. I was a classical clarinetist, and I was reasonably good at it. And I used to practice. And I went through a lot of what I call the practicing was actually the exercises of the social engagement system without co-regulating with another. It's a very interesting journey, because what are you doing when you play the clarinet? You're blowing out. You're exhaling slowly. You're utilizing the muscles of the mouth, the embouchure. You're controlling, as I said, the breath. You're listening with your ears to deal with the intonation. And then you have intentionality in what the acoustic sounds are. And so you're going through this whole process on a daily basis. And I was doing this, an hour a day when I was a teenager. And I had not thought too much about it. You know, I had, well, when I would do all this practicing, it was really, I was in the physiological state of exhalation because I was exhaling while I was doing this. And I realized that it enabled me to traverse that difficult period of time that many adolescents have. And I played the clarinet through college, and then I stopped playing it, and then I started becoming a scientist. And interestingly, the roots of the ideas and the thoughts and the processes regarding breath, regarding a sense of connectedness, a sense of control, and the use of all the facial muscles stayed with me. And then later I learned that that was also the techniques of pranayama yoga. And in a sense, playing the clarinet was an applied pranayama yoga and polyvagal theory, especially the social engagement system. Pranayama theory is yoga of the social engagement system. So you start seeing all these things coming back, and that the ideas, even though novel today, and even based upon our new understanding of neurophysiology, are still intuitive ideas that have been with humanity for centuries.
Part of what strikes me in your response is that if we take a philosophical orientation, if you will, that connectedness mm-hmm. is a biological imperative, as the title of this presentation states, that changes how we view the world, and that change is really powerful and could lead us to new kinds of insights and discoveries.
Yes, I think it is really, really powerful, because connectedness is everything. And it should have been the first principles that we're taught, that you know, we are, as a species, need to connect with one another. And as I said, this whole understanding of safety is critical for this nervous system that we inherited to function well. And there's another point that I also make. I make not only that I say that safety is not just the removal of threat, I also make a statement that we are a traumatized species and that we've always experienced trauma, and many people will experience and they'll always experience trauma. It's our understanding of the reactions to trauma and our compassion of how we can help others, support others, and help others co-regulate through difficult times that really is the gift of our species.
Well, I want to thank you so much. We co-regulated each other through the noise of the academic environment where you
next,
are.
Next time, I'll do it from home.
Oh, it's okay. I appreciated the opportunity, and I really appreciate your very good work and how much it's helping so many people. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you very much, Tammy. Thank you.
This concludes our fifth live session of the Neuroscience Training Summit. Thank you, everyone, for joining us and for your excellent questions. Please note that the recording of this session will remain accessible and for free for 24 hours. If you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, transcripts from each session, and bonus gifts from our presenters. Please join us for our next live session, which will be with Peter Levine on trauma and memory, brain and body in a search for the living past. This session will take place approximately 5.5 hours from now at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Again, my name's Tammy Simon, and for Sounds True, thanks for being with us. SoundsTrue.com. Many voices, one journey.